Now, before we dive right into it, I don't know about you, but so these guys, we just honored them this morning. Sorry to put you on the spot here. You know, we have people who get engaged, a lot of them, because we've got quite a bit of students. And I thought to myself, I wonder, you know, just thinking of myself when I was little, when I was younger, and you know, if somebody were to ask you, what should you be looking for in a marriage partner one day? And I thought to myself, I'm sure there's some really funny answers out there. You know, there's these shows actually, like, you know, kids say the darndest things or whatever. And it's true, you know, you ask a six-year-old, what's his idea of his dream wife? You know, you're gonna get some interesting answers there. some funny answers. So the question then that was posed to a few, let's say, 10 years and below children, is the following. How does a person decide whom to marry? Right, so now Kelly, this was in America, Kelly, age 9, said this. You flip a nickel, and heads up means you stay with him, and tails means you try the next one. I thought that was quite funny. Okay, how about Carolyn? Carolyn, aged 8. Okay, Carolyn said this. My mother says to look for a man who is kind. Now that's good advice, and she remembers her mom's advice, right? That's what I'll do. I'll find somebody who's kind of tall and handsome. that's hilarious. How about Andrew? Okay, Andrew, age 6, this is what he had said. One of the people has freckles, and so he finds somebody else who has freckles too. Alan, age 10, said the following. You got to find somebody who likes the same stuff. You know, that's sort of sensible, I suppose. Like, if you like sports, she should like it too. And she should keep the chips and the chip dip coming. Last one, Kirsten. Kirsten, age 10, said this. No person really decides before they grow up who they're going to marry. And this is probably the most biblical answer here, with a bit of a twist at the end. God decides it all way before. And you get to find out later who you're stuck with. Oh man, I thought it was hilarious. Okay, so those are the views of some kids about, you know, what to look for in a marriage partner. Now I'm going to turn this on eldership. You see, here's the thing. Sadly, sometimes churches go about finding elders in the same way. Honestly. It's sad but true, but some churches have a childish approach to getting the proper leaders in their position. You know, we can't, obviously, I mean, the point is so clearly made that we cannot have this kind of approach when it comes to elders, all right? As much as it is an important decision to marry a person one day and to not just be the right person, but to look for a person who is godly and wanting to serve the Lord, the same applies to finding godly leaders for the church. And here's the reason why I say this. It is a marriage. I don't know if you know that. But a church is literally married to their elders, okay? As the church as a collection is married to the Lord. Just think in terms of Ephesians 5. Ephesians 5 makes it so abundantly clear that the Lord is the head of the church, and so the church submits to the Lord. But the Lord has also allocated leaders to lead and to exercise oversight over the church, who then basically sees these elders as their leaders, the ones that they are married to. That's why it's so vitally important to get it right from the get-go. And I know it's not a foolproof way, because who can look inside somebody's heart and actually see the true intent of their heart? That's not possible. But as far as is possible, it should be absolutely necessary to ensure that somebody who aspires to eldership should actually be qualified for the job. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. Right, not only have we seen the nature of godly elders, not only have we also looked at the function of godly elders, we're also going to be looking at the actual qualification of godly elders. The qualification of godly elders. And this all finds itself under the bigger heading, the credentials of an overseer. That's what we've been dealing with for the last few weeks. the credentials of an overseer. So here's the third and the last point that we're going to be looking at, the qualification of the man. You see, this man must be qualified. And I'll tell you it from the get-go. This is comparable to a doctor, okay? You know, interestingly, people make more intense decisions about the GP they're going to be calling their doctor than the actual pastor they're going to be calling their pastor. And it's sad because it smacks of a total indifference that reigns in the world with regards to spiritual matters. See, the choosing of an elder, the choosing of a pastor, shepherd, man, that is so important, and it is of eternal value. It is of eternal consequence. Because if you're going to be fed junk, then you're going to turn into junk. But if you're going to be fed good and wholesome meals, Sunday after Sunday, week after week, wholesome meals, one after the other, then guess what? It's going to show spiritually. There's no two ways about it. What you put in is what you'll get out. But turning the spotlight on you now, because I know it may have been easy the last few weeks for you to tune out a tad or two, I guess, because, you know, it's about eldership, and you know what, I'm not really interested in any of that. Plus, hey, I'm a girl, so it's not for me, all right? But hey, maybe I'll be marrying a guy one day who's interested in this kind of thing. And so there may have been the temptation along the way to be tuning out a bit. But I'll tell you what, today is one such day where you can't allow yourself to tune out. Why? Because the responsibility is yours. It's your responsibility. The Lord looks to the church to ensure that you are being led by godly and qualified men. Now, I know some of you are already thinking, yeah, but I came to this church and things were already okay-ish. They're not yet a plurality, and we know they have the desire to work toward a plurality, and that's great, and they're actively seeking to do that. But things seem to be in order. But I'll tell you what, the next moment there's somebody, a candidate, an aspirant elder, strong on the way, somebody who's eager to serve, I'm not going to be the only guy who the Lord's going to look to present somebody. No, look, it comes by recommendation of the elders, to be sure. But in the end, it has to come alongside the whole church. The whole church has to be in unison about the election of a prospective man of God who's going to seek to serve the church in love. It's a team effort. And therefore, it is vitally, vitally important for you to know what to look for. You must know what to look for. In some way or another, we might want to be like these kids, see? Ah, as long as he's a good dresser or something, you know, that'll be fine. As long as he's an interesting speaker, I guess. You know, as long as he throws in a couple of jokes every now and again, then, you know, he should be fine. Or maybe, you know, maybe he's a nice and sociable kind of guy. You know, I like to visit a lot. So, you know, as long as he's, you know, open house policy is a good policy. And then I'll be okay with that. And so we, unbeknownst to us almost in a sense, we have these things or these ideas about a pastor or an elder that's not necessarily biblical. So here's what the Bible has to say about elder qualifications. The first thing is this: an elder must be blameless. That's the first quality you want to be looking at in a person who has been called to lead you as a child of God in the church. Must be blameless. Titus 1 has it all covered for us. Let me read to you again from verse 5. This is why I left you in Crete, so that you might put what remain into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife, and his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination. For an overseer as God's steward must be above reproach. He must not be arrogant or quick-tempered or a drunkard or violent or greedy for gain, but hospitable, a lover of good, self-controlled, upright, holy, and disciplined. Now that's a mouthful, isn't it? But this is, in a nutshell, the qualifications of a godly elder. But it starts with this all-encompassing quality, or really central quality, which is to be above reproach. Another word for that is to be blameless. I've already said that. An elder must be blameless. It is from the Greek word that literally means without accusation. A man that cannot be accused rightfully. A man that people cannot point fingers at him for some obvious thing that's going on in his life. Blameless, above board, above doubt, really. See, he's the kind of man that people shouldn't be doubting over. And that's a problem, because in the church at large today, there are too many men in pulpits, in pulpit ministries, who are doubtful, who have doubtful habits. And they say things that are doubtful, and they do things that are doubtful, and not above board. And that is a shame. It really is a shame to the ones who allowed him to get in that position in the first place. See? An elder must be above board. You see, what we're talking about here is that core, basic, biblical principle. It's really a godly quality of being somebody who not only preaches, but actually practices what he preaches. To be blameless means to model the Christian virtues, not just preach it, not just learn about it, not just think about it and accumulate knowledge about it, but actually to, in practice, live it out before the flock of Christ. That's what it means to be blameless. And there's various examples that we can draw on in terms of explaining it, maybe just practically bringing it home. I mean, here's one. Let's say if... Okay. You know, there's a thing going on, especially in Reformed circles. You might have heard of the young, restless, and reformed. Okay, now let's say I was a YRR candidate. Then I would typically be doing my evangelism in the pub down the road. That's what I'd be doing. You see, because they see that as normal and okay. They see that as, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, go and have a pint with a guy, and maybe he'll see you're not such a stuck-up, and then maybe he'll be more open to the gospel, or that kind of thing. Now you see, I do understand that we need to be salt and light in this world. I'm not doubting that fact, but I am convinced that there are ways to do that and ways not to do that. Because the worst thing I can do is cause you to doubt me. That's the worst thing I can do. That's why long ago, my wife and I, we made the decision, not a single drop of liquor will touch our mouths. Why? Because I want to come across as blameless, see? That's why. I want to come across as above board, as above reproach, not a wine bibber, not a drunk. We're going to get to that. But it starts with that core central quality of being blameless. Okay, let's just call a spade a shovel here. Is it ever truly possible for any person to be totally blameless? Yes or no? No. Not possible. Why? I mean, what does our human constitution teach us? We're sinners, right? And we will be sinners until the day the Lord comes for us. Until glory, you and I, we will be sinners. And here's a little newsflash, that counts for me too. I'm not a superhuman being. I know you may think that sometimes. No, you don't. No, you don't. Okay. You know I am totally like you. And I love that fact. I love it. But there is a sense in which you have enough trust in me and in a prospective and an aspirant elder that you put your trust in us, in a group, in a plurality of elders, and you will place your trust in us eventually, knowing that we strive to be above board. That is our heart's cry. That is our main drive. That is our main desire. That is what we live for. This is what makes me tick. It really is. To be above reproach. Because the moment I'm not above reproach, then technically I'm disqualified for the job. If there's reason to doubt my character, if there's something going on that's just not good, then really, technically, I should have the decency to step down and get my life in order. I'm not saying that's instant disqualification, right? I think there are things that will forever disqualify a man for the job of an elder. But I also do think that there are some things that should disallow him to continue on in his position as an elder in order to go set time aside, get his life in order, and then again be seen as above board, above reproach, blameless. I hope I'm making sense in how I'm saying this. I have friends in the ministry who've had to do that. And perhaps, and it's all within God's plan for me, right? And for any other elder who will eventually join me. But maybe that will be necessary for me at a stage in my life to step back a bit, get some things in order, recommit things perhaps that has run away from me or that I have allowed to run away from me, to get that back in order, get back in shape, and get back and ready to lead the flock of God again. But until such time, the drive is to be blameless. The drive is to be above board, above reproach. Keep on living what we preach. That's what the Lord calls us for. And so the very first quality that the Lord mentions here, again through the pen of Paul, Paul's the one who said these words, is the fact that this man must be seen as above board in his most primary relationship, and that's his relationship with his wife. So point number two is this. A godly elder must be monogamous. That's a good word. We understand what it means, right? Monogamous. It's really from the Latin mono, which means single or one or apart or whatever else you want to say. And gamos, which means to be married. That means to be in that relationship. Monogamous, monogamous. But if you want to look at the actual Greek meaning of the word and the actual word that Paul employs here, let's go ahead and read it again from the beginning of verse 6. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife. You see, in the ESV, it doesn't really give the punch of the Greek word that Paul employs here. Because if you were to dissect the Greek word and if you were to look at the actual way in which it is employed, what he really means to say is that because there's a lot of misunderstandings that can be spawned from this one term that Paul employs here. What he really means to say is that this guy must be known as a one-wife husband, in terms of using it adjectivally. If he's a husband, he must be known as a one-wife husband, not a two-wife husband, or a many-wife husband. That can't be true of him. He must be known and he must be trusted as a man who is totally 100% committed to his one and only wife. A one-wife man. And yes, sadly, this is something that men of God can be tested in. This is something where, and usually this is reason for disqualification. It's sad when it happens, because what happens when a man falls morally, when he's no longer classified as a one-wife man or a one-woman husband, it sends shockwaves throughout the church. When things like that happen, that's usually when you have church splits, when you have dissensions, when you have churches really imploding in one way or another. It doesn't have to be, but sadly, that's some of the repercussions of men of God falling into immorality. He must be a one-wife husband. Now, here's a few questions that we might want to ask, because again, the way that the ESV has translated these words, it might give the impression that Paul has in mind a few other things. The husband of one wife. For one, here's the first question. Does this disqualify men who never married? Does this disqualify a man who's, in other words, he's been celibate and single for his whole life? No, this is not what Paul is saying. If this was true, then, you know, the great late John Stott could not have been an elder at All Souls, right there smack dab in the center of London. Okay, that would not have been possible for him. So this is not what is intended by this word. Okay, it doesn't mean that he must therefore be married. But sadly, in some churches, they see it as such. Okay, I do believe that there is a sense in which a church can learn perhaps a few other things from a pastor who is married with children, because they see him with his wife and his children, and it becomes a very valuable tool for the church, right? An example to live by. It becomes a teaching, a tool of teaching. But certainly, single men who never married are not disqualified because they don't have a wife. This is not what this means. Okay, so secondly, does this disqualify men whose wives are deceased? Does this disqualify a man whose wife died, for instance? No, also not. This is not what Paul means by this. There are pastors that I know whose wives have died. In fact, maybe some of you might remember Dr. Martin Holt from Constantia Baptist. His first wife, she died early, and he married again. Okay, so then technically he would have been disqualified if this is what Paul meant. Definitely not. This is not what Paul meant by this. All right, so here's the third and the last question that somebody might want to ask. Does this disqualify each elder whose marriage fails? And this becomes a bit more trickier. Does this disqualify every single elder whose marriage fails? And I want to say one thing, but then I'm going to qualify it. So before there's outrage, I'm going to say this. No, I don't think this disqualifies each and every elder whose marriage ends up in divorce. Why? Because this passage doesn't teach that. There's simply no passage in Scripture that actually teaches that. You see, what will determine elder qualification for a divorcee or a divorced and remarried man will be his behavior during his previous marriage. So the point is this. Was the man who's now divorced, and there's grounds for divorce, believe you me, the Lord Jesus gave grounds for divorce. He said, except for adultery. Okay, remember that. Remember the Pharisees came to him. Okay, so adultery, and according to Paul in 1 Corinthians 7, desertion is another grounds. But that's essentially something that automatically happens. The person leaves, and they're the one who goes and divorces. So for those two reasons, if a man has been above board, he's been blameless, he's been above reproach, and his wife walks out on him, in other words, he's been exemplary, or there's adultery, I don't think he's disqualified for the ministry. I don't think he's disqualified as an elder. In other words, it reverts back, what Paul is saying here, reverts back to that very first quality. Blameless. Has he been blameless? Has he been a solid character? Because again, if he was not above board during his marriage, then they would be doubting of him as a man of God. There would be doubting of him. There should be suspicion, and people should be suspicious of him. There's one example in church history, I think, that deserves to be pointed out. Many of you will remember the life and times of John Wesley. Now, Wesley traversed the Atlantic, I think, at least 7 or 8 times in a time where there were no jet planes. They did that on boat. And he was zealous for the gospel. Wherever he landed in the Americas, he got on horseback and he would ride from town to town preaching the gospel. And that's how Methodism spread throughout America. And even Charles Spurgeon spoke highly of Wesley, save for the whole Arminianism thing. And that's something we would even disagree with in our church. But here's really what was most lamentable about Wesley's ministry. Not so much the Arminianism. What was most lamentable about Wesley's ministry is the fact that in one sense or another, his drive for the gospel led him to neglect of his family. Sadly. It led him to neglect his family. It led him to neglect his first ministry. And that is his wife and his kids. And it got so bad for his wife that she started to resent him. She started to resent him for heading off in different directions for months at a time. And then back in England, that same zeal would send him from church to church to church. That's the kind of man that he was. So, okay, yeah, in one sense he did good things, but in the process of doing those good things, he did one big bad thing. He allowed it to happen, and he allowed his marriage to crumble. It got so bad, I'm not sure how true this is. Maybe one of you can help me out. But apparently it got so bad, and she got so resentful towards him. She would sit in the front pew and she would shout obscenities at him when he would preach. You can go check me on that. That's how bad it got, because his zeal for good things came in the way of that very good and first ministry in his life. I'll tell you what, and I need your help, okay, with this. You got to help me with this. I can never allow what I do for the church to get in the way of that woman sitting back in the corner there and my kids. That woman is my wife, by the way. Just wanted to make sure you know who I'm talking about. All right. You guys have to help me with that. I can't allow that to happen. She's my first ministry. My love, you are my first ministry. I cannot allow anything else to get in the way. And she'll tell me, don't you worry. I love that about her. She tells me before she gets here in the front pew and starts shouting stuff at me. She's still six rows away, so thank the Lord for that. No, you've moved up one row. No, I'm just kidding. She'll let me know, and she does, and I love that. And even this week was a thriller, okay, because we had Christmas carols, we had a little women's conference, many things happening in our family life. She had to prepare a special breakfast this morning, which she loves, and she does that in her stride. But she told me last night, love, it's time for a time out. And I said, amen, preach it, sister. Let's do it. And let's go big, okay? Because it's important. See, family comes first. So if I neglect my family, I look especially to the men to come to me and tell me, Lungren, are you sure you should be doing this? Are you sure you should be getting involved with this? Have you made sure Anna's okay with this? I mean, that's fine. That's fine for you guys to do that. Because you got to understand my heart. I'm so zealous for this town. I am so pumped up and passionate about this town and bringing more souls to glory that I would just want to run and go for it. That's me. But I can never allow that to happen at the expense of my wife. Never, ever. Because the moment that happens, I got to get things back in order before I'm disqualified. Sad thing that happened recently. A good friend of ours in the circles that we move, his marriage fell apart, and it's largely because of the fact that he was too zealous for ministry. It got in the way. Ministry got in the way of his first ministry. And you know how that happens? It doesn't happen like in a moment, like, okay, so ministry got in the way, I'm going to divorce you. That's not how it happens. It happens over time. And you see how it happens in the wife. She loses an interest in the things of God. And she starts doing her own thing. And the next thing you know, it's like it's two oxen, you know, who are yoked together, and they're pulling in different directions. That's how these things play themselves out. So this is a warning. This is a warning for me. This is a little reminder for me today. But it's also a little warning for those prospective elders, those men who are zealous to lead, to know that this is the main focus. Must be a one-wife husband. Alexander Strauch put it so well, and this is largely to do with the actual meaning of the term that Paul uses here. And Strauch did an amazing job. Maybe some of you might know which book I'm talking about. It's a book called Biblical Eldership, and it was written a number of years ago, and it's really like, I guess you could say, after the Bible on eldership. This is kind of like a uncapitalized little Bible on eldership. It's an amazing book, all right? It's a must-have for any prospective elder, and this is what he has to say about Paul's exhortation here. And this is in the context of those who see this in the wrong light. They don't really understand what Paul talks about here. So he says that some prominent biblical commentators believe that this phrase means married only once in a lifetime. Paul, they say, prohibits remarriage for any reason, even remarriage following the death of a spouse.
Thus, a man who was divorced and remarried, or a widower who had remarried, wouldn't qualify to be an elder or a deacon. This interpretation, however, is plainly at odds with the rest of the Bible teaching on the sanctity of marriage. Nowhere else in the New Testament, and he quotes biblical expositor J.E. Huther here, or Huther, who said this, nowhere in the New Testament is there the slightest trace of any ordinance against second marriages, end quote. And then he goes on, he says this, by itself, the phrase, the husband of one wife, doesn't indicate whether Paul means one wife in an entire lifetime or one wife at a time. The phrase must be interpreted within the larger context of Paul's overall teaching on marriage. It must never be allowed to contradict God's clear general teaching on marriage. So that's obvious, right? Of course, you know, everything that applies to marriage should apply in the man's life. Until such time, for whatever circumstance, and we've already now punted out, we've put it aside, those circumstances where he is the guilty person, where he is the culprit for his marriage falling apart. But any other circumstance, adultery, desertion, not disqualification. Again, if he was above board, if he was above reproach, if he was blameless. I think Alexander Strauch said it wisely. He must be a monogamous man. Now here's a third quality. And again, it's just an expression of being above board, above reproach. The third quality is this. A godly man must have children that are not rebellious. He must have children who are obeying, who are respectful. He must have children who are not like the typical unsaved youths within, let's say, godless families. That should be a given. And you must bear in mind here, Paul addresses Titus within the context of the Isle of Crete. Remember, on the Isle of Crete, there were all kinds of debauchery going on everywhere. Rebellious kids everywhere, rebellious youths everywhere, disobedient, disrespectful of their parents. That was rife on the Isle of Crete. So Paul was saying this, for a godly elder, a man who aspires to the ministry, his kids cannot be like that. Why? Because it's obvious, right? Because they're going to be the ones who are going to be looked at. They have to be an example to the rest of the church. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife, and his children are believers and not open to the charge of debauchery or insubordination. Really what it comes down to is the parallel passage found in 1 Timothy 3:4. He, the elder, must manage his own household well, with all dignity, keeping his children submissive. Now, let me just say a few words about what it does not say. This does not mean that only men with children can be elders. Again, there's some people who think that. they read this and they would immediately come to the conclusion that only men who have kids can be elders. That's not what this is saying. Now, I am suffice to say that if there is a man who aspires to eldership, but he and his wife constantly chooses not to have children, there's something wrong with that. Okay? I'm not sure how to explain it, but there's something not on with it, especially because children are such a blessing. They're from the Lord. And again, looking at that statement in Genesis where the Lord gives him the responsibility to go and take dominion, God said, multiply. Right? It flies straight in the face of that. So there is something not right with that. But let me just say this, and this is good for us to notice. It doesn't mean that he should have children. There are many couples out in the world who simply can't have kids. And you know what? It doesn't mean that means that everybody has to adopt. It's simply not for everybody. Some folks can adopt, and they love it, and they're good at it, and it's wonderful, and it's needed, and that's also a biblical command. But it's not for everybody. Here's something else that this does not mean. It also does not mean that it is absolutely, or that it absolutely must be provable beyond any shadow of doubt that the children of an elder are saved. Can I rephrase that? This does not mean that it must be provable. In other words, to where everybody is 100% certain that my kids are saved. This is not what it means.
So then what does it mean? Well, it simply means, as Paul instructed Timothy, that an elder's kids, an elder's children, an elder's offspring have to be submissive. They must be submissive. And here's why I say it would be inordinate and it would be wrong of us to place that requirement upon an elder's shoulders,
because there simply is no promise in Scripture to be found anywhere, Old or New Testament, that the children of the godly will be saved. No such promise to be found. Even in the Proverbs, where Solomon wrote those words, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's older, he will not depart. That is not a promise, people. That is a wisdom. In other words, this is what wisdom dictates. Wisdom dictates that if you teach them well, then technically they should be able to make the right decision when they're older and stick with it. It's not a guarantee. And I have no more guarantees than any of you.
Just because I'm in the position of eldership doesn't mean there's more guarantees or a greater warranty coming along with me.
Definitely not. My kids, even though we pump them full of biblical doctrine day after day, seeking to live Christ before them, modeling Christ every day of our lives, I know and I must be open to the possibility that one of them or two of them, and we pray that it will not be the case, might go astray. It happened to the great John Piper. And for a time, he stepped down. And because he was older, I suppose, he just saw that as a great segue to hand over the baton.
But it does not mean that it must be scrutinized in such a way that they absolutely, without a shadow of doubt, should be seen as saved or redeemed. So then, how do we make sense of this in terms of what Paul says? Because he says, he does use the word, they must be believers or are believers. If anyone is above reproach, the husband of one wife and his children are believers. So how do we make sense of this phrase believers? Because certainly we understand it as to indicate upon faith. In other words, salvation. We have to understand it in what follows after it, because Paul didn't include these words to Timothy. What he means to say is that as long as the children are under the roof or the care of the father, in other words, as long as the children are under the authority of his parents, they must be compliant and they must be respectful toward the faith of the parents. That's really what it comes down to.
They must be submissive. They must be teachable, respectful, let alone they must not be rebellious. And it's happened before. I have colleagues, not just here in South Africa, but also in America, who had to step down for a while because they had to deal with rebellious children. And often these things hit you in the teens. That's when it happens. Okay, so right now, look, what we're dealing with little ones, I mean, that's not half of our trouble once they start hitting 13, 14, 15, 16.
Because that's when the true depravity comes out. But by God's grace, Lord willingly, our kids will be of the elect. And they will have made the right decision, that is to follow the Lord for the rest of their lives. And not walk down that road of rebellion, as some children often do. Philip Towner, and he is really an authority on 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. Philip Towner explains it really well. I'm going to read to you just an excerpt from his commentary on 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, and Titus, if I can find it. Let me just see here. Sorry, guys. Momentarily. Here we go. Listen to what Towner had to say. And this is under the heading, Appointing Church Leaders. Appointing Church Leaders. He says this, and he's talking about believing children, right? He's talking about children who should not be insubordinate and disrespectful or rebellious. Quote, we might wonder how such a requirement would be measured. In this case, Paul may again draw upon the wild stereotype of Cretan society. Remember I said that.
Remember how bad and debauched Cretan society was. So Tyra goes on. He might have drawn on the stereotype as he describes believing in contrast to behavior that belies genuine faith. Not open to the charge of being wild and disobedient. He goes on, he says this, the legal language of accusation does not here envision a formal legal setting. The sense here is of accusations that might come from any quarter. And then he launches into some technical language here, but I'm going to skip ahead here, and he goes on. He says, Paul adds this, disobedience, better understood, rebellion or insubordination to uncontrolled conduct. Notably, this is precisely a characteristic of the rebellious teachers troubling the communities, whose behavior Paul will shortly caricature by drawing on the Cretan stereotype. With the household setting in view, the implication is of disobedience that has reached the level, and this is where you must pay attention, where it has reached the level of flagrant disregard for the father's authority. It seems likely that Paul places this behavior on the continuum leading to the misconduct that characterizes the opposers of the gospel on the Isle of Crete. I hope this makes sense. This must be viewed in terms of that inordinate, immense level of rebellion that was experienced on the Isle of Crete. And yes, sometimes an elder's kids can be like that, and that's the point at which he steps down. Now, I make that commitment to you today. If that ever happens in our family, that's exactly what I'll do. But we cannot say more than what the Lord has said, right? We cannot turn this into a precise science of determining and being able to say, the elder's kids absolutely must be saved. Can you say that about the person sitting next to you? How about that? The Bible says the human heart is deceiving above all things. We can play the game. We can put a front. We can bear false fruit that only later in time will be proven as false fruit. I can tell you a story about a colleague of mine out in America. He's a teacher right now at the Master Seminary, whose wife, after I think 20 years of marriage, came out saying she only played the game. She only put a front. And she was actually baptized by John MacArthur after really getting saved. But for the lack of being able to prove absolute salvation in somebody, I make to you the commitment that I'm going to strive to keep my kids in order, respectful, subordinate, not rebellious. And the moment that that happens, I will step down. See? Because that's what this passage means. His children must not be rebellious. Here's a fourth quality, or a fourth characteristic of a prospective elder. He must not be proud or quick-tempered. He must not be proud or quick-tempered. I love this. For an overseer, verse 7, for an overseer as God's steward must be above reproach. See how Paul rehashes that central quality again. It all, every time, reverts back to that central quality again. Is the man blameless? Is the man above board? Is the man above reproach? For an overseer of God's steward, as God's steward, must be above reproach. Rehashed right there in verse 7. And then he now continues on by talking about a few extra qualities. He must not be arrogant or quick-tempered. I mean, that simply cannot be true of an elder. That cannot be true of a man of God who deals with God's people day after day. And I'll tell you what, it doesn't mean that they're not tempted in that way. I'm sure maybe some of you have thought, man, that was kind of arrogant of him. And then maybe sometime later, I think about it, and I think to myself, yeah, maybe that wasn't so good. And we get tempted that way as well. But as a rule, as a general rule of life, I cannot be seen as an arrogant or quick-tempered person. In other words, I cannot be seen as a person who has a short fuse. I cannot be like that. Because that would again fly in the face of what Paul told the church. Teach, rebuke, exhort with all patience. It comes down to patience. points back to long suffering, being long suffering with people, bearing with them, being patient. I cannot be somebody quick to the trigger, quick to get angry, quick to get whatever. I must be controlled. An elder must be somebody who is known for their self-control. I mean, there's much more that can be said about that, but just go and read through the Proverbs and you'll read what is some of the damage that a quick-tempered or an ill-tempered or an arrogant man can cause. And Solomon even warns, he says, don't even associate with him. Don't spend time with him. Don't remain in the same house with him. Same as even said of a woman. Okay, yes, we're talking about elders here. But it's even said, don't dwell under the same roof as a contentious woman. It's better to just go sit outside. And the same is true of a quick-tempered and an arrogant and an aggressive man. And for us men who are desiring of leadership, guys, this is important because we're men, we got testosterone, don't we? Right? We love to get out and go and do it. And we're quick to the trigger and we want to get things done, and we've got to be careful because this is one of our qualifications. I'll tell you what, in church, sometimes things, I said this to somebody this morning, sometimes it happens as slow as molasses on a cold winter's morning when you want it happening now. No, you want it happening yesterday. You gotta be patient. You gotta be long-suffering. You gotta bear with people. You gotta carry their burdens along with them. And if you think you've rebuked enough and there's still no change, then you gotta rebuke another 20 times in love. With all patience, all temperance. That's my job. I should never lose patience with you. And sometimes I wonder, did I say it right? Because it seems like this person is not getting it. And maybe I didn't say it right. But then I go back and I come up with new ways of explaining things and explaining God's will and God's oracles and His commandments in our lives. And then all of a sudden there's fruit, and I'm reminded, this is so incredible. This is wonderful. This is great. Or you know what sometimes happens as well? I could be saying something until I'm blue in the face. And then somebody hears it from somebody else, and all of a sudden they understand it. Clearly, they got it. And I'm like, that's wonderful. I mean, that's great. It's excellent. You know, have you ever had a moment like that, and you're giving somebody the textbook answer, and they're just not getting it. And then somebody comes along, and like, no, it's like this, man. Like, you know, and they use an illustration or two, and all of a sudden the lights go on, and it's just incredible. The rest is history. I can't let those things get me bogged down. Definitely not. That's all part of God's working. That's the way God works. That's the way God sanctifies us. But it's done through patient serving, being long-suffering with God's flock. Here's the next quality that Paul addresses. An elder or a prospective elder cannot be excessive. He cannot be excessive. Let me ask you, what does it mean to be excessive? Excessive living. Have you ever heard somebody say that or something? They're living a bit excessively. What does it mean? Help me out. Go on. What does it mean? Corvus? Thank you. Right. Okay. Given too much. Right? Okay. There seems to be a bit of lack of control. well said. It seems like excessive living seems to imply that the person is a bit, and they've lost control of things. And no longer are they in control of the things in their life, but those things are in control of them. So in other words, that can't be said of an elder. Definitely not. Okay, so there's three things that he points out. Number one, and this is an obvious one. This is so funny, actually. It's almost laughable. He cannot be a drunkard. I mean, this is a no-brainer, guys. An elder cannot be given too much wine. Definitely not. An elder cannot be pitching up at church and reeking of last night's get-together. That's simply not, that cannot be said of an elder. And so I've already shared that. You don't have to worry about that with me. But hey, the moment things might change and we lay down our guard,
and you start suspecting some things, guess what? This quality right here, well, this is the one that's going to be in danger. Cannot be a drunkard. Again, Proverbs warns against people who drink too much. Wine is a brawler. Wine is one who's like thus. He wants to punch you. He's a fighter. And that's what too much wine will do to you. So just to have any second guessing, just to knock that right out of the way, any doubt right out of the way, we don't partake a single drop. It's not that we impose that on you, definitely not, because nowhere does the Bible say that it's a sin to drink alcohol. You can go check me on my sermon that I preached on that. It should be online somewhere on our website. But it does indeed say that it can lead you down the wrong road. It can lead you down the wrong road. I remember in high school prose, Afrikaans prose, we did these short stories, I forget now. I think it was called Verlore Paradise. It was a collection of short stories, Afrikaans short stories, wonderful, wonderfully written. And the one story was about this very humble builder called Joppy. Like his name says it all. He loves a job, all right? He just wants to get his hands busy and build a job. And the thing, so the story goes, he's really actually being asked some questions about his life by a bystander who's really interested in his life. And so the guy just assumes basically that he's a drinker, because most builders are. I don't know, maybe not. But so Joppy says, no, I don't drink, Joppy says. And so he explains to the one who questions him, he explains to him, why not? And he says, well, you see, it's like this. It's really quite humorous in Afrikaans. Just go and look that up on your own speed at home. But I'll just translate it. He says, you see, wine, alcohol, is like a donkey. It's like a donkey, a mule. And as those of you who know anything about mules, when a mule gets tired, what does he do? So if you're on the mule's back and he gets tired, it's not just stopping right there dead in his track. He'll throw you. He'll buck you off of his back. So that was his view of alcohol. It's like a mule. If it gets tired of you, it'll throw you. And heaven knows where you'll land up. An elder cannot be doubted for these things. Definitely not. He cannot be violent. That's the next quality. He cannot be an aggressive man. You see, so the first point of stopping there is really what prevents the next. Okay, so he cannot be given too much wine, because then essentially that'll also tempt him to be aggressive. These are all almost in a sense linked one to another. But even without the assistance of alcohol, without the assistance of anything, even without his morning mojo, you know what that means, right? Even without his morning cuppa, coffee, you know, the caffeine fix, he should be a temperate guy. He should be a non-violent guy. He should be a kind guy. He should be somebody who has time for his flock. Not a fighter, not somebody who's constantly wanting to cross somebody, prove a point. Sometimes that's part of a person's personality. And so we're going to be mindful of that. We're going to look out for these things. If there's warning bells in a guy's life, like this guy likes to fight, he likes to be disagreeable just for the sake of disagreeing, we're going to be seriously doubtful of his qualification to be a prospective elder. Because in an elder core, it'll lead to dissension. It'll lead to discord. It'll lead to the opposite of scientia est virus. Right? No, not that one. Sorry, that's something else. Eendracht maakt macht in Dutch. What is the Latin? Help me out. Anyway, but you know what I'm talking about. It'll fly against that. In an elder core, there has to be unity. There has to be harmony. And so there can be no rogue candidate. There can be no rogue rebellious molecule in such a core of elders. Because there are men called for the sole job that lies ahead, and that is to love and to lead a flock. That's what they're called for. And so, the next quality that Paul touches on is that very important quality of not having long fingers.
can't be greedy. He can't be somebody who's in it for his own gain. He can't be somebody who is more mindful of the rewards of being a pastor. And there are rewards, trust me. And we are daily rewarded. And not just financially, emotionally, in other ways. We are rewarded day after day. But he cannot be in it for those tangible rewards alone. Money. He can't be in it for the money. He can't be in it because he wants the next and greatest car or household item or whatever it may be. And sadly, we look out on the church landscape today, the landscape of the church, and again, I'm speaking of Christendom as a general term. It's almost as if pastors have become the greatest, latest new CEOs of companies. I mean, have you checked what these guys fly in? I remember hearing the story of some prosperity guy out in America who got his church to buy him the next best private jet. And he had one previously, but the problem was that it wasn't the latest one. It wasn't the latest one. And his issue with the previous jet was that he had to make a few stops somewhere along the line of doing a transatlantic flight. And so he wanted the best, newest jet that can do that once, you know, non-stop. I thought it was quite hilarious. And the way that he sugarcoated it for his congregation is that he said that it'll be better for the gospel that way, because then he can get there quicker. I love it. Okay, so it's like if I were to tell you I need a Ferrari, okay, because I need to get to evangelism quicker, before anybody else, okay. I mean, what would you think about me if I said that? It's like, you got something else up your sleeve? Cannot be greedy. Cannot be greedy. Two last qualities here. This number six is this. Must be hospitable. What does it mean to be hospitable? Well, it means somebody who has an open door policy. I always tell you that. We have an open door policy at our house. We want to be able to receive people into our home. Perhaps even have something for them to eat and drink. We want to be sociable with our people. And an elder must be known as that. There's something wrong with an elder whom you've never seen inside his home. There's something that's not right with that view or that picture. And we used to attend a church. I was a member of a church previously where, I don't know, we thought about some of the elders there, and they're good and they're godly guys. But we got the impression that they lived a closed-off life. It was almost as if their homes were barricaded to the rest. And you saw them at church and they were the life of the party and they were Mr. Social par excellence. But the moment they left, you knew little about their domestic lives. Because why? You never got invited in. That's why. You never got invited in. There were never a meal served. Never perhaps even a Bible study of sorts or whatever. That cannot be true of a prospective elder. He must be a hospitable man. And I'll tell you what, that is a general rule in Scripture. It's a general rule for all Christians. We must be hospitable people. If you look at the Lord's example alone, how many times did the Lord Jesus serve his disciples by providing food for them? And not even just the disciples, I'm talking about those true guys who were truly saved. Not even just them, but all the followers of Christ. How many times did he feed them? No less than 2 or 3 times. In a miraculous way did he feed them. And yes, I know you're thinking, but it's the Lord, and I mean, he can feed everybody. He feeds us all the time. But when Christ was a man, he was hospitable. He received guests, if you will. The very last time he served his disciples, he cooked fish for them on the beach. He said, come sit by me. Come enjoy this with me. You must be hospitable. And here's the last and really that grand jewel quality of the elder. And it's coupled with being above reproach. He must be able to teach. And I'm not going to say much about this today. We're already out of time. It's already 15:15. Because we dealt with it during the characteristics, right? The functioning of an elder. We looked at teaching in quite a lot of depth. But this is what Paul has to say, lastly, verse 9. A man who is above reproach must hold firm to the trustworthy word as taught.
You must hold firm to it so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine and also to rebuke those who contradict it.
This is what governs all. Every interaction, it is all based on revealed truth. So, dear listener, dear brother and sister, I hope you've been blessed this morning by our last installment on biblical eldership, or a godly elder, what God expects of a godly elder. I hope you've again realized your responsibility in this equation, that God looks to us, not just me, us all, to get the right men in the place where they need to be. But here's one last reminder. Our Lord is sovereign, isn't he? And he is over everything. We cannot go about these things without pleading daily that the Lord will constantly lead our church. See, if he doesn't go before us, we can try as much as we like, we're not going to succeed. And my heart's desire, and this is just where I lay it bare to you this morning, pray for me, please. Please pray for me. I'm on my own right now in this job of leading this church. Pray for me that I won't lose heart. Pray for me that I won't burn up, burn out, whatever. But also pray that soon that God will provide more godly men alongside me. That's my heart's prayer. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much for this morning. Thank you for these words penned many, many years ago, but still so fresh, so relevant today, so true. The truth of it has never been fluctuating. It's always been pure, unadulterated truth. But Lord, and we do beg of you that you will help us as a church, help us to be governed well in love. And Lord, I pray that as we do that, that we will see the product in our people, that we will see a church that flourishes and that's growing and that's developing. I pray, Lord, that we won't lose heart if we don't see things happening overnight. But may we apply patience and may we be long-suffering. And Lord, may it be that the right men get placed in the right positions. Thank you, though, Lord, for these folks. Thank you for the people that we do have at this stage already in various positions where you're using them. And in some way or another already, we feel like they're irreplaceable because they're such servants and they're so zealous, and thank you for that. But I do also pray, O Lord, that soon that you will help us to develop into a plurality of elders, because we know that that's what the word requires. May we be governed well, lovingly, kindly, patiently. And as we do that, O Lord, may we do so until that day that you come for us collectively, for your church. And we know that that day onwards, we're going to be with you, and there will be no more sin, no more fallen existence, and we will be with you.